Welcome to Maxed Out Man, helping you become the man you were made to be.
Hey guys, it's Kevin Davis from the Maxed Out Man podcast. This is episode number 28. I am here with Judith Weigel, the amicable divorce expert. She runs a podcast and she is a divorce mediator extraordinaire. And this should be a super interesting conversation. I told her when we were kind of getting set up that this is, you know, this would be interesting to see between someone that has been married for 28 years and I'm kind of like anti-divorce, to kind of get, you know, and a child of divorce. So I'm super interested in having this conversation and kind of just bringing it to light and see what we can do to educate the audience. So thank you so much, Judy, for coming.
My pleasure. And everybody's against divorce until they have to get one.
I guess that's true.
For divorce, but when it has to be, it has to be. So you've done very well for yourself, married as long as you have been.
Yeah, we've, you know, ups and downs for sure, but it's been we actually are happier now every day than we were yesterday. So that's not something most people can say, but yeah. So I think we're doing something right, or at least she is, by not killing me in my sleep. I think maybe that's the,
this place, out of New Jersey, I think some years ago.
For sure. So why don't you, if you want to, I just did a, you know, that's your very brief, introduction, but I'd love to kind of know more about what you do, your history, how you got to where you are, and kind of what you spend most of your time doing now.
Living in the past. No, one of my favorite sayings is, after a hard day of living in the past, this is what I've learned. Okay, so all jokes included, I have come from, my background is in live entertainment. When I transitioned into divorce close to 12 years ago, I say, well, this is more like a dark comedy. This is more of a drama if I'm going to continue to keep myself in the entertainment space. But here's how it worked. At age 5, I started my own production company in the garage of my house. I quit kindergarten, so I am probably one of the few kindergarten dropouts you've ever met. I do have a very good friend who was literally thrown out of kindergarten for behavior. So I found a kindred spirit. But early on, I knew I wanted to entertain people and I knew I absolutely loved entertainment. So from that, you know, go through school. My first big job was with the Clyde Beatty Cole Brothers Circus. And this does actually tie into divorce. So I had trained myself I was a classically trained musician, flutist, went to college for music and realized, oh, playing field is way too tough here. I'm not as good as I was. How good you are in high school, that is really different when you get to college. Playing field is different.
And it's probably similar to sports, right? It's like the sports thing. It's, you know, depending on what level you are, your skill set and expertise varies.
That's right. But I was prescient. And for people that want to do what their calling is, I'm very big on that. I remember when I had told my dad that I wanted to change from a music major to something else, and I wanted him to allow me to explore the talents that I had, which were speaking, writing, so journalism, communications, philosophy, and English literature. He said, okay, you know, it's fine, do what you want to do, but do you have any idea at all what you would like to do for a living? And I said, you know, Dad, I really don't. And then I got silent, and I think this is where the heart and the mind kind of came together without me thinking about this ahead of time. So what came out was very prescient. I said, I don't know what I want to do. I know I want to work with as many cultures of people in the world possible in as many places in the world possible too. And I don't know what that means. And he said, okay, do what you have to do. 7 years after that. So I graduated from college, knocking around jobs to support myself, but nothing I really wanted to do for life. And there it was. This was in the days when excellent jobs were listed in the classified section of the newspaper.
Yep.
And I read the ad that changed my life. Circus, circus. See the country. We need marketing directors that have background in entertainment, journalism, and communications.
Wow.
What I had already explored. And so I said, okay, well, this is definitely my gig. The marketing director, the chief marketing director came through Pittsburgh. That's where I'm from. Pittsburgh Steelers, yay. That's where I'm from. I was there one for the Thumb in 81. I went through that whole series when they went from the dust to perfection. So I was right there in Pittsburgh when that happened. Anyway, I sat down with Tim Stinson and I said, so you're going to hire me. This is my job. This is what I foretold 7 years ago, and I will be one of the best marketing directors you've ever seen. He said, okay, I guess I have to hire you. So he hired me. I joined the circus in Niles, Ohio. They were in the middle of the tour, and I met my future husband that first day on the job. He was in the band. He was on the midway eating a hot dog. So I walked up to him, and I said, I think I know you. Let's talk. And so the rest is kind of history. When we got divorced many years later, it was just the groundwork for what I'm doing now. I was amicable. I was hurt. It didn't matter. I knew it wasn't a great relationship. You always know. You always know. Don't fight it, because you're going to make both of you will be miserable. And so I just went with it. And I remember that whole year. I just came out of a meeting earlier today with a new client for filing, because I'm also a paralegal who files. And I just said, you know, I think it was like the pain of childbirth. If women really have that as their memory, there won't be that many kids born. You kind of have to get rid of that memory in order to move forward. I don't remember at all what happened that year, but I remembered that I was not about blaming. I was not about torturing. I was not about being above. No, come on. This is something that didn't work out. Let's rectify this. Let's move forward. And we're still friends today. And so I think when I finally came to this family law gig 11 years ago, it came into my life. I never woke up one morning and said, God, I'd love to work in the field of divorce. The people who work in divorce deserve medals. I know I'm self-serving by saying that, but we deserve medals. It is tough ass stuff. It's just really difficult. It's harder than generating revenue for a company. It really is, because you have to really keep yourself centered and placed so that all of their sadness doesn't take you over. It's easy. Like therapists, you know, how do they do their job? You only go to a therapist when you need help. So yet they're happy people, most of them. You just have to get good at blocking that out, yet giving compassion at the same time. It's really a skill in the art. But anyway, in between the circus and this, all of my entertainment, I worked for the Chicago Lyric Opera, Sarasota Opera, Children's Opera Company. And then I moved out to Los Angeles, the hills of Beverly. I love Los Angeles. I love Beverly Hills. And I started working with my brother. We produced live entertainment for private events. And even though Eddie Murphy, when he was on Saturday Night Live, made fun of musicians who worked for weddings, let me tell you, in Los Angeles, you can put all of your children through college by doing weekend weddings. And the people who hired
you, that was the Adam Sandler wedding singer movie, right?
Oh,
like,
God.
he was kind of the joke.
He opened, what was the song? I love, the little grandmother sang that song. It wasn't Right Round. I don't know, maybe, oh, it was Right Round. I love that tune. But Eddie Murphy was the one that did the spoof on musicians that played private parties. And I'm like, Eddie, if you ever need to augment your income, and I know where you live, we've done events. You should be a musician for a wedding. I mean, these people spend as much money on a wedding as you spend on all of your children going to college.
That's crazy. It's crazy, honestly.
Yeah. So, and now, well, here I am, trying to make harmony out of people's crumbling lives. Seriously.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine. And the stereotype, of divorce attorneys, and I know you're not a divorce attorney, but you know, the stereotype of is they're, you know, they're like the lowest of the low attorneys out there, and all they're trying to do, you know, they're kind of having to do the fighting, and they're just trying to grab from, you know, each of them, the attorneys are fighting like T-Rexes over every last morsel that's left and all that. So you over say that again.
Over the Velvet Elvis painting. So Kevin, there's this judge. When I teach this recipe for a heart healthy divorce course, and I talk about settling the emotional divorce before you settle the legal divorce, meaning get through the grieving, apologize, forgive, accept, and then start the filing. I tell a story about judges, two different judges who won't let people fight in their courtroom. They just won't let it happen. And there is this judge, Terry A. Crone, out of Indiana. And he's famous for saying, when I have self-representing litigants in my courtroom who are fighting, it's always over the Velvet Elvis painting. I call it the toaster, but the Velvet Elvis painting. He said, everybody has one. It's never about the Velvet Elvis painting. It's always about the hurt that hasn't been handled before you start filing. And he said, I make them leave my courtroom, and they are only allowed to come back when they're no longer fighting.
Yeah.
I think that's interesting. I think we need more people. But to your point about divorce attorneys, this is a tough space. Well, they are one step above the personal injury ones.
That's true. Yeah, I'll give them that for sure.
Well, the personal injury ones are the only ones that have billboards and advertising, because there's this position in law that you're not supposed to sell your services. Well, I think that's poo. Sell your services. You're a business. They also don't look at themselves as business people. I said, what are you talking about? Business is the exchange of service for money. That's all business is. You exchange product for money. You exchange service for money. You are a business person. Now act like one.
Yeah. So
in the world of family law, I am lucky enough to be surrounded by fabulous attorneys who will not take your money if you don't have a big enough case. If you have a case that I can do, they refer to me or other people like me, document preparation people, because why should they charge people in LA $425 at the least an hour, you know, looking at a $20,000 to $50,000 divorce without going to court? They just won't do it. They just say, no, you can handle this through somebody else, less money, and you'll be fine. And then there are the other attorneys that blow everything out of proportion, and you pay for things you don't need. And I wanted to, with you, because of the intention and the type of podcast you have, I wanted to make a statement to men. Mm. It's a hopeful statement. And I want to tell men, this is not 20 years ago anymore, 30 years ago. You will not lose custody of your children. You will be able to see your children. You will not be taken for everything. When people say, oh, I was taken for, that's not possible. There is no state in the union that lets one person walk with everything and the other person get nothing. It doesn't happen like that. But I do want to give that hopeful message to men. It's a new day. Do you remember that film, Kramer versus Kramer, with Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep?
Mm-hmm.
That was a classic, groundbreaking movie. That was the very first time a man got full custody of a child. And the man was more nurturing than the woman.
Mm.
And that happens.
When so my parents divorced when I was 6 and I'm 50. So that was almost 45 years ago. And at that time, this was rural Texas. And at that time, I mean, my mom was not a good mom. She had all sorts of, you know, chemical habits and all that. And she still got full custody. Like back then, the moms literally could have been a crack whore, which crack didn't exist at that point, but could be, you know, a terrible mother, and they would still give you full custody. So I waited till I was 12, went before the judge. That was how that all went. So, so I actually, and kind of picked my dad at 12. So I kind of raised myself from 7 years old, on my own because of the full custody thing. So I would have actually been better off with my father, but it just didn't happen back then. That's not how things
were. Right. It was really different back then, but it isn't now. But let me ask you something, because you've raised a really good point. People who live under adverse circumstances as a child, they can either use it to be phenomenal, successful people like you, or it can destroy their lives. It really is how you use it. So when that happened, when you were left in the house with your mom and you saw that she had adverse conditions to being a healthy mother and running a healthy household, how did you react? How did you pull yourself together?
You know, in my case, I've always just thought that it was like a God-given personality to make that possible. I'm a multitasker now. I have 4 businesses, 12 brands, serial entrepreneur. I do tons, and I've just always been that way. I kind of don't need a lot of sleep. I'm just very high functioning in that way. And I think part of it is nature, and part of it is nurture. Like, I was literally taking money out of her purse from child support to buy my own food. I would not see her for days at a time. I'm 7 and 8 years old. So I was like a latchkey kid with just the keys, and you know, there wasn't anyone around a lot of times, and it's a bizarre, you know, to my kids grew up in a very stable home, and I try to explain some of that, and it's just the concept is almost foreign to them. Yeah. That someone, but it's funny because my sister's very well adjusted. She's about 8 years older than me. My brother's gone through many divorces, has had some other issues, difficulty in his life, but he's 13 years older. So he was out of the house by the time any of this happened. So it's interesting but he grew up in probably an unhealthy marriage at that point. You know, some mental and chemical issues going on there with both my parents. And so, at that time. But it's a bizarre, that's a hard question to answer. You kind of caught me on that one a little bit, but it's a hard question to answer. But I think it's just, you know, I just had this innate ability of survival, and just kind of do what needed to be done. And I still, you know, at 50 years old, I still do the same thing. I'm just one of those. That's just kind of how I run.
That's wonderful. Now, is your mom still living?
She is. We do not have a relationship. Primarily because she's kind of a toxic. She's very toxic. And she was dangerous to our family. I'm not here to share about my mom. She'll never hear this anyway, but it's funny, 'cause she used to send me Father's Day cards and birthday cards and put pictures of me when I was a little kid and write over them, "This is when you used to love me." So at some point I was like, all right, this is probably not healthy for you to send, you know, cards to my children saying that your dad's terrible and won't talk to me and all this stuff. So I made one last ditch effort to say, hey, I'd love to have a relationship with you, but these are kind of these are the boundaries and all that stuff. And it just didn't happen. But
it's always fascinating to me how you can have 2 or 3 siblings all raised in the same household or under the same conditions, and they turn out very, very differently. And so I kind of look at it as your upbringing only does so much for you. It's what's inside that takes over, and the learning lessons that we're supposed to have each in our lives, we get those learning lessons, and then we just have to do something with them. And hopefully, you know, we get through them and we prosper and we become better. And if we don't, well, that just means we have to figure out what we didn't learn. So yeah. No, that's really great. And I'm always impressed, like Sean Combs, you know, if we're going to use somebody really, you know, hugely well known, he grew up in a very tough situation too, but you know, he rose above it, and so do a lot of people rise above it. And then you have the trust fund babies, you know, then you have people that have more than enough for their entire lives and can't put it together. So nobody really wants to grow up in a dysfunctional household. It's better if you don't. I thought I grew up in a great household. And still, I have two siblings, and we're very close. Both parents are gone, but we each turned out slightly differently. And we all grew up with the same parents. So it's what we make of our lives, right? And doesn't this speak more to the theme of your podcast? It's what we make of our lives that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I always think of life similar. I'm a big physical fitness guy. I lift weights several days a week and have just always done that. And the way I think of life with the trust fund kids versus someone that goes through adversity, the way muscle growth works is you literally break the muscle down and your body senses that it's going to do that again. So then it repairs itself and adds additional muscle fibers, which that's caused muscle growth. You get stronger so that you can essentially preemptively growing to anticipate that same heavier load. And so that's why you have to constantly lift more weights and all that. And I think life's the same way. I feel like that these, and I was actually worried about that with my own kids. You know, we're not ultra wealthy. We're not trust fund wealthy, but they grew up in a, upper middle class white family in Montana, which is pretty homogenous and pretty conservative and straight laced. And I wanted to give them, experiences, because I think trust fund kids don't often have difficulties. No one tells them no, in a lot of cases, and they don't learn how to deal with challenges. They have their own challenges, almost like they create them. But with my kids, like I sent my 14-year-old to Costa Rica for 6 months to go learn Spanish. And she's been to Nepal, and my, other daughter has been to Brazil for months at a time. And, when they've traveled more than I have before they were the age of 18, and so, but to purposely give them that exposure.
Yes. Yes. Well, first of all, Kevin, I secretly wanted to be a trust fund baby and a supermodel. I thought that my life would be perfect. I would be grateful for all the money I had. And when you're a supermodel, everybody likes you and wants to be around you. So I just thought that would be great. That hasn't happened. And I don't think that's going to happen till the day I die. But I think when you don't have challenges, so the trust fund babies, they don't have challenges making money. They have money. But when you don't have these challenges, it doesn't test you. And when things test you, you have to dig deep. You have to be creative. You have to be centered. You have to know where your resilience lies. And we all need to be that way. So, looking back, that's my way of saying it's okay if I wasn't a trust fund child. I dug deep. I overcame challenges, and I'm okay with where I am today. I am.
Yeah. And a lot of people don't get there, right? Like that's something, there are very wealthy people that are teaching their kids, that it's like the old Bill Cosby line. It's like, you're not, from the Cosby Show, he said, Theo at one point said, "Hey, we're rich." And he goes, "No, son, you're not rich. I'm rich." there's a difference between, but I think like Shaquille O'Neal, I think he has a certain way that he handles money with his kids. I think Will Smith's the same way. I think there's several that kind of have taken steps to at least help them to stand on their own two feet a little bit.
Well, what about Warren Buffett? Isn't it well known? Am I right when I read about Warren Buffett that he's not leaving his money to his kids? And Bill Gates just carved out a little slice of wealth for his kids. I think because both of them understand, unless you really work for it, it doesn't mean anything. And then those who have that altruistic personality, and that aren't caught up in the ego of the money, they actually want to put their money to good use. And they do. They do. Mm-hmm. They don't want to die with all of that money. So I these are some of my heroes. These are people I look up to, and good for them.
Yeah, for sure. Cause you gotta let your children at least, you know, we did this thing with our kids when they were getting cars. We said, hey, we'll match you dollar for dollar. They started saving when like they had a little piggy bank that had basically, you know, savings, giving, and then spending. So there was this little three things baked, but they started saving for their car when they were like 9 or 10 years old. And we matched dollar for dollar what they had saved so they could double the kind of car that they bought. I didn't buy either of them a car. They each bought their own first cars. We, you know, and they were, I mean, they're, you know, we probably put $3,000 or $4,000 towards it. They put $3,000 or $4,000 towards it, which is a pretty decent used car. Yeah. But they, you know, they had friends that had just been given a car, whether it was used and crappy or not, they wrecked them all the time and they didn't take care of them. And our kids paid for their own insurance and like that. You know, there are certain things that you can, certain steps that you can take a little bit at a time to teach kids some of that responsibility.
I love that. I really do love that. And you know, when I was in college, my dad first year paid for tuition, room and board. I mean, college was nothing. It didn't cost anything close to what it costs now. When I decided to change majors, I said, I'm going to help out. So I became a resident assistant. And I can't believe they let me do it. I was so wild in college. But I was in charge of a floor. And so he didn't have to do that. And I was happy to do that. That made me feel really good. And then when that gig was kind of over after a few years, to finish college, I moved home, but I had a job. I didn't want to not work. I wanted to earn money. I didn't want anybody to give me any money at that time. So yeah, earning your own money really means a lot.
Yeah, and trying to teach the kids, you know, and this obviously this we're talking mostly to dads here, but trying to teach your kids that responsibility and it's so funny. Both my kids were homeschooled. They both left home at 17. I have one that's paramedic, one that is actually doing data acquisition and research. So but they're both gainfully employed. And it's funny because my youngest, who's 23 now, when she was in between houses in college and she didn't live at home. But she was local. And I said, well, you can always come back and stay with us for, you know, a month or whatever. And she said, if I did that, I would feel like such a loser. And so I was like, that's great. I mean, like, because she had such pride in doing, and honestly, like if she really had needed to, but she had already made other arrangements, but it was one of those things where she had such an independent spirit about that. Like, I want to take care of my own stuff. But I know if I really need it, that dad's there for me. And we've, you know, we've helped her with short-term loans and all that. She always pays us back. Yes. You know, we do loans. We don't do just like total gifts. It's like, I'm not just here to give you money. You're an adult, but if you need a little cash to get you by, you know, for a month or whatever, we could do that.
Yes. So. Well, you know, one of the things that I actually regret is when I was 16 years old, I went to my parents and I said, I think it's time to leave home. I think I'm done and I'm on my own. But I missed the part that I had to earn a living to completely support. I said, so we break down what you spend on my food, what you spend on my clothes, what you spend on me. Do you think you could pay that to me? And then I would go get an apartment. I really missed this. And I'd always worked as a kid. I can't believe I missed the step where, no, if you're going to leave home, you actually have to support yourself. You can't make a trade-off. And so a very good friend of mine calls me Rebel Light. And I said, you know what? I think you're right. I think I am Rebel Light. I think I have these grandiose ideas and gestures, and I start expressing myself, and then I pull back, and I apologize. Did I express myself too much? Should I apologize to anybody what I said in the meeting last night? And that's when my friend Stacy said, Judy, you're Rebel Light. Come on. You're Rebel Light. I said, no, I think I like being Rebel Light. That's kind of a cute term. But if I were to do it over, I'm really respectful of people who leave home at age 16 or even 15. They're ready. They know themselves. Maybe they're philosophically not in line with their parents. And if they stayed there longer, that would change them. And I loved my parents dearly. They were great parents. But I think for my own health and growth, if I'm to be honest about, you know, the pros and cons of how I made decisions, I think I would have been better if I had left home at age 16. But that didn't happen. So here I am.
Hey, guys. Thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you're enjoying it and learning a lot. If you're looking for extra help, don't forget that I do offer one-on-one coaching. We can talk through a ton of different issues. I can give you guides, guidelines, and logistical help to help you take that next step or go to that next level in some of the things that you're dealing with in your life. We also have some course content, some guides, and a lot of educational materials over at maxedoutman.com. For the coaching, go ahead and go to maxedoutman.com/coaching. And you can learn about that. And then just go to maxedoutman.com for everything else. Thanks for joining us. Now back to the episode. Ours were 17, and they were, you know, both had their equivalency, you know, when you're homeschooled, you don't graduate necessarily, but you do basically they call it the high set, which is basically the GED in our terms. So, but both of them were ready to go. And they, you know, my youngest went to EMT school, became an EMT. They both tried college for a little bit, and it just, for neither of them, you know, being homeschooled for so long was not, that really just wasn't a great fit. And then now my youngest is actually she wants to be a medical doctor. So she's back in school but she's a full-time paramedic too. So yeah, they both left home kind of early, and, you know, I always call it the entrepreneurial approach to parenting and to schooling, especially when we did their homeschooling. It's just, it's a dynamic approach, not real textbook, you know, to use a pun there almost. But yeah, they turned out pretty good. We have our moments, but I think that they left home at the right time. So if we're talking about, go ahead.
I'm just going to ask you a quick question. Why did you decide to homeschool?
Well, we did this thing. We took the kids out of school when they were fifth and sixth grade. And we did a 3,000, we did 100 days, 34 states, 12,000 miles in an RV around the United States. So we pulled them out of school for 3 months, 3.5 months. And we basically traveled the United States as full-time RV family. But at that time, what we had them do is, because we went to so many historical sites or historically interesting sites all up and down the East Coast and the Eastern Seaboard and Boston and Colonial Williamsburg and all of those places, we actually had them shoot videos and do paperwork at each location. So we kind of homeschooled them, and then we reported that back to their teachers. And this was 16, 17 years ago, I guess. So it's been quite a long time. So this is kind of early in the, you know, the blogging or vlogging days. Right. We had a little blog and kind of did that. So that led us to, like, hey, we could do this. And we traveled quite a bit. We wanted that freedom. I've been self-employed for 25 years. My wife is a stay-at-home mom. And so we had this freedom. So we figured, why don't we just add to that freedom, let them learn on their own timeline, and there you have it. We kind of took them out, and but they went back to school after that, but they, about sixth and seventh grade is when they were just ready to kind of do their own thing at home.
Did they bring it up as well?
We kind of brought it up together, but yeah, they were definitely, it's not, we didn't just pull them from school. It was a decision that they made effectively, you know, at their age. We don't, you know, kids, when you're 12 and 13 years old, you know, long-term decision-making is not exactly well-developed, but they knew at the time that was something that they wanted to at least try and see how it went.
Okay. Thank you. Just to end that, one of the reasons why I asked was because when I'm doing divorce mediation, and I run into a situation that's homeschooled, it's just an interesting conversation to have and why people do it. And one person will typically be in charge of it and the other person will be working. But
we did it kind of, so I had, it was CDs at that point, but I had a home network that I set up, and I'm kind of a computer guy. My first business was web development, but We basically use CDs and online. Now it's everything's online, but at this point it was CDs and they submitted homework and it was really self-teaching. Mm-hmm. And we're fortunate in Montana, fortunate, unfortunate, depending on the kid, but the homeschool laws are very generous to parents. I know in California, they're pretty ridiculous. It's very difficult to homeschool your kids in some states like California because there's so much bureaucracy and, mm-hmm. you know, they basically try to force you back into school, which I'm not, you know, I'm a bit of a libertarian when it comes to that stuff, but, you know, so they drove that process and, it was something we all kind of did together.
On the circus, the kids were homeschooled. So on the circus, there were families and the families had children and the children actually eventually went into the act of their parents. But during the day before the performances started, there was typically in any one year, a woman who had been a teacher. She didn't really grow up in a circus family. She married into one, had children, and she became the teacher for all the kids on the circus. And that was kind of cool to see school go on. Just like actors on location, you know, if they're kid actors, they'll have a teacher on set so that you don't get behind.
Yeah, it's kind of a tutoring, in a tutoring aspect, or even like old school, you know, single schoolhouse, rural towns back in the day when they used to, everybody was kind of in the same classroom. But I'm interested in more of what you do also in terms of like, if obviously our audience is mostly men, you know, there are women that listen to this, of course, but how do you guide men that are either already going through the divorce, kind of have decided that that's the only outcome, you know, that's the best outcome for them? We do marriage mentoring and we've done kind of premarital counseling and that kind of stuff as kind of lay people. Mm-hmm. And so with our marriage mentoring, we actually talk a lot about that, you know, we want to do everything we can individually and together to make this work. Right. And we've been fortunate that we typically deal with situations that are not far gone, right? Like it's something that we're not even close to that divorce precipice at this point. We don't often deal with a lot of like seriously in crisis people, but like if you're in that situation as a man, especially, how do they navigate that? Because I know that even in our society, men typically are kind of the enemy a little bit, you know, in this, you know, I think in terms of, not enemy necessarily, but I think that we get less credit in some, when you watch the media, let me just say that, like we're kind of presented as the bumbling idiots or it's all our fault or, you know, something, that kind of stuff.
First of all, I hate that image. I literally hate that image. That has always bothered me for my whole life. I don't like people portrayed like that. It's wrong. Well, you know, there's not a one size fits all situation, but so I'm going to break it down into a couple categories. There's the situation where the man has caused the divorce. So here's a story. Married 30 years, 28 of those years, man was in a relationship with another woman who was also married for all that time. And wife finds out. Devastated, has lived her entire 30-year marriage thinking she was just married. It was just the two of them, right? And it ended up not being the two of them. Those men typically don't say, I'm sorry.
Right.
Those men typically have nowhere to go because they have literally lived a double life. And it happens more than people think. So there's no guidance for those men. There's just, you can't come with judgment. You don't live their lives. I'm just there to do a service for them. Mm-hmm. It's the men that crumbled under external circumstances that led to the divorce that my heart goes out to. Men are looked at still as being the stronger ones. I mean, at least on the surface, but you know, women are really tough.
Yeah, I live my life in a you know, female tradesperson. My wife's an off-road racer. She does welding. We've built, made tons of vehicles with all women teams. So anybody that would tell me that guys are stronger overall, I just, you know, they're totally wrong. She's also a boxer, so I'll just have her punch them, you know, to kind of prove that she's not the weaker one. But
by the way, I bet she's a size six. I bet she's a small woman.
She's beautiful. She's actually 5'10". And, you know, she's physically fit, very physically fit. So, okay. Yeah. So she could definitely kick my ass. Let me just say that. So,
I love her already, Kevin. Some woman I need to meet her now. Okay.
But you were saying that they're typically portrayed as the stronger of the two.
Well, physically stronger generally, and supposedly can handle anything. Well, they can't handle anything. I mean, that's a ridiculous stereotype.
Right.
So we have to get rid of that. People are people. And I think men are having a difficult time getting rid of that stereotype too, and able to be expressive in terms of talking about the needs that they have, the emotional needs, the intellectual needs, the social needs. But in terms of the men that got crushed by circumstances, either something happened in their lives and they weren't able to meet that challenge, oh my God, this is where my heart really goes out to them, because they don't know where to go. And you can tell me, this is what's in my head, you tell me. When a man is not producing financially, because this is society's expectation of men, when men are not producing financially and it's not their fault, shit happened. Don't crush them, women. Don't crush them. You know, I'm sorry this happened. If you have children, it's a drag because you need to raise your children to have money. But no, when I see them sitting in front of me, I try and be very, very careful with how I talk, because when you're meeting with them, it's all about money. I mean, divorce is all about money. It's separating people financially. It's looking at community property or equitable distribution of assets and debts. And you could just, they don't even meet my eyes. I mean, they're looking down the entire time because this is so embarrassing. This is bone chilling, horrible to them. And they need their confidence boosted. You know, they need to be told, hey, this happens to everybody. So you just have to rise above this. You have to figure out, you know, where your new center is, and you definitely have to get therapy. You need a coach, you need a therapist, you need somebody in your life to get you back to center. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, because men, you know, I think society puts that on us, but I also think in my mind, just with me personally, there is an innate desire and responsibility that comes with being me as a man, to be the provider and the protector and, you know, all of that. You know, it's funny because I, even though my wife is a much better shot than I am with a pistol, we're gun people. I still have that. And she's strong in her own right and a boxer and all those. I still have that sense of protection for her. And so part of that support and provision is financial, right? So there's a lot tied up into men's self-esteem with being able to provide that.
Yes. And very difficult. So I wonder how you would react if something happened. We have a lot of irons in the fire. You don't just have one iron in the fire, right? But what if you became financially devastated? How do you think that would affect you?
We've been there, actually. What's funny. And, you know, with us, we've taken a lot of my wife and I, who I usually refer to as either, she has two names. She's either my smoke show hot wife or my bride. Those are typically the way that I refer to her. But we've been very aligned on all of the major, you know, if you take all that big list of the things that cause, you know, strife in a marriage, we've been very well aligned, and we're always super honest with each other about things. And we've had times, you know, we're making negative $50,000, you know, being a business owner. We had years that sucked, and it's just like, all right, well, we talk together, we work through it. We say, okay, here's what we need to sacrifice. These are the steps we need to make. You know, does she need to go back to work? She's been a stay-at-home mom. She took early retirement from public relations when I got my first health club back in the late 90s. But yeah, we actually were able to weather that situation because she wasn't the type of person to say, well, that's your problem. What are you going to do to fix it? Had she been that, it would have been a very difficult situation.
Wonderful. No, that's brilliant. The fact that you could come together and talk about it, and there was no blame. It was just, this is what we have to deal with, not what are our best choices going forward, and that you did it as a team. And I think that's great. So there's the man that's crushed financially, and then there's the man that's crushed because he really didn't want the divorce. Mm. Marriage is untenable, you know, for a variety of reasons. And there's a child, and there's a small child. And the fear immediately creeps in, I'm going to lose my child. And this is a nurturing man. So one of the things that happened in the court system was that people started realizing that men can be nurturing too, and maybe more nurturing than women. And so why are we giving the child to mom all the time? Why aren't we in the best interest of the child, which is a phrase used in court systems now, the best interest of the child is to have exposure to both parents, because each parent will teach the child different things. And it's very important to have a well-rounded child. And I remember I was in the middle some years ago in a divorce mediation, and I don't really know what happened in the marriage. And it wasn't financial. Something else happened. And this woman was just relentless by saying, no, the child belongs with me. The child belongs with me. I think 2 years old, maybe three, but very young. And he broke down and cried. Mm. And he said, I can't imagine a day not seeing my child. You know, I feed him, I diaper him, I bathe him. You see that I'm an involved dad. How can you not want him to have me in his life? And it was all about retribution. Right. So whatever happened, she was very angry. And so the child became the bartering tool in all of this. And one of the things women say is, well, I've been reading all these psychology books and the attachment theory. So there's this thing called the attachment theory. And the theory goes, the child should be attached to the woman, not the man. You know, BS. The child needs both people. And quite often the child is more attached to the dad than to the mom, because the dad is very nurturing, very understanding, very patient, will listen, will allow the child to express him or herself. And so the dad said, I'll never, ever forget this mediation. The dad said, look, if you're worried about cooking, I'll take cooking classes. I'll take cooking classes with you so that you know I can prepare food properly for our child. Whatever the rules are, whenever you want him to go to bed, I will do that for you. I just cannot not see my child. I want overnights with my child. And so I said, let me have the room. And so he left the room, and I said to her, look, I do a lot of these mediations. This is the first time I've seen anybody willing to change to the level of having you be comfortable so that he can participate in raising his child. Who doesn't want to be married to somebody like this or divorced to somebody like this, knowing full well your child is going to be very safe when your child is not in your home? Well, she got mad at me for siding at him. I said, no, I'm not siding. I don't know you two. You're strangers to me. I'm sharing with you. You have the best situation known to mankind. You have a parent, a father, who is willing to change his life for his child. Mm-hmm. And then you can form your life. So anyway, So we worked it out, and yes, he got to be with his child. But, you know, there are moments you'll never forget when people bare their souls. And so, you know, my heart goes out to everybody. You know, women inherit situations that they don't deserve, and have to deal with them, but so do men. And I just want men to know that the world recognizes now, I think the world does in large measure, that you have feelings, that you're important to your children, and that you will sacrifice and do what you have to do to raise your children. And when there's a divorce and there's a choice, or when you have to hire attorneys, there are attorneys that specialize in men's rights. There just are, that understand the manipulation that can go on, and men may lose their rights with their children. Oh, there's this thing called parental alienation that I'll get to in a second, which is horrifying. Poisoning a child's mind against a parent, and typically against dad. But if you are a man and you feel that you might lose time with your children, you know, you only get them every other weekend, which is so crushing to me. That's how
it was with my dad, every other weekend. Yep.
What do you accomplish every other weekend?
Nothing.
You know, you have to be a part of a child's ups and downs. What happened in school that day? What happened at the baseball game? I mean, you have to be there when your child goes through their experiences of life so that you can do what a parent does, is supposed to do, and that is guide them through it, you know, and center them so that they can grow stronger from these experiences. No, dads need to be in their kids' lives without.
Well, I was actually, and I'll let you continue, but I was, there's a Facebook page I follow called The Art of Manliness. And they actually posted an article on Father's Day, which Father's Day was just not too long ago, about a week ago. And I can't remember the statistics, but it basically gave all the statistics on what happened once our society moved to fatherless situations. And in this case, it was, no longer having a father in the home. But I think in context, it's not having a father in the life of the child. And it was, you know, the number of incarcerations went through the roof. The number of unplanned pregnancies went through the roof. The number of actual abuse situations as an adult for young women actually increased. Like all of these factors, you know, the dads are super important. Like anybody to say, and you know, there are single moms working their asses off out there. There's no question. And if there's a man out there that happens to be a father, but not a dad, then that's on him. And right. That's unfortunate for the child. But if there's men that actually want to be a part of their child's lives, you cannot give them a better gift than to allow that, you know, long-term.
Absolutely. And for any women who may be listening to this, it doesn't detract from you. You know, having a strong man, having a dad there wanting to participate, it takes nothing away from you. Men and women are different, what they can add to a child's life. And a child wants both people. A child's not evaluating who's more important to me, mom or dad, right? They want both mom and dad, or they want dad and dad, or they want mom and mom. I mean, whatever the situation is, they want both parents. And for one parent to try and control the connection and the ability for their child to see their other parent, woe to that parent. Yeah. When the child gets older, the shit's going to hit the fan. Am I allowed to curse, or should I?
Sure. No, you could do whatever you need to.
Rebel light. I don't know if I would apologize to the audience and you.
Yeah, you don't need to apologize. By the way, on a side note, almost every dinner party we go to, I have to ask my wife afterwards, was I a lot, right? Like, I was too much? Was I a lot? Yeah. Because I have a very loud voice. I tend to be very witty, and I tend to take over the conversation. So I'm going to just start calling myself Rebel Light also. Maybe that's what I need to do.
A little group from this show will be a band of Rebel Light people.
There you go. You were talking about parental alienation, and I'm interested in that concept. I've kept you for a long time, but I want to get into that for sure.
Okay. Parental alienation is when one parent alienates their child from seeing the other parent. And they do it in a number of different ways. Typically, they badmouth the other parent, or they will be very emotional when that parent's name is brought up. They don't even want that parent's name brought up. I thought it started with the divorce. I interviewed somebody on my podcast, Ron Berkless, a couple weeks ago, who said, no, it started in the home when they had children while married, that he loved his children dearly. And now he's working in the state of California on parental alienation rights. But he said he noticed that he would be criticized. Whatever he did with the kids, he would be criticized in front of the kids. And then she would make it so that he couldn't go out and play ball with them or take them on walks and do what he normally was doing, which he loved participating in his kids' lives. And the parental alienation started then. And then he couldn't take it. After 4 years of marriage, he had to get divorced. And then it became death con. And then he started realizing she had some issues. You know, she had some psychological issues. And I don't know. I think this was in England, though, this happened. I don't think it was in the United States. And I don't know that their court system was set up to deal with it at that time. But I interviewed a gal from Greece who wrote a book on parental alienation because she was a child alienated from her father. And what happened to her was dad had another relationship and mom, of course, didn't like it, but could never get over it. Ever. And mom was extremely emotional all the time. And the child thought that she had to rescue her mom. The kids think like that, that they have to rescue their parents if their parents are sad and unhappy. And in order to rescue mom, that meant she had to make the decision, the child, not to see dad, which mom, of course, loved. But yeah. Dad didn't know how to handle it and figured, okay, so as my daughter gets older, we'll talk, we'll figure this out, I'll get her back. I think that's the hope maybe of parents who are alienated, we'll get them back. Mm-hmm. This is an expensive court process. This is a destructive court process. But what do? This is the worst situation in the world when one parent will either fight during the divorce to keep the child away from the other parent. And there's nothing wrong with the other parent. There's no drugs. There's no alcohol. They make a good living. There's no valid reason for this parent to not see their child. It's destructive, especially if the parent loves their child. How do you function like this? And you spend years trying to change that. And you're either lucky enough to get a decent judge who can think. Now, here's the problem with judges. I mean, it's the law. There's no emotion attached to law. It's law, but there's a complete emotion attached to parenting. Mm-hmm. And if there's no behavioral issues that would be adverse to the health and welfare of the child, why can't you just make sure the child is with both people? Why can't you make it a court order? It really depends on the judge. Now you get personal issues coming in that shade a judge's ruling, which is horrifying. You just have to hire the right attorney. So what Ron was saying in the podcast, that was only a couple of weeks ago, so tune in, go look for it on the Amicable Divorce Expert podcast, and I put show notes there. And he said, find a lawyer who literally understands parental alienation. Take them through it. Ask them questions. Ask them about other cases that they handled and what was the outcome, because they can say they understand it. Doesn't mean they do, it just means they want the case. Yeah. And there's a lot of money in representing somebody in a parental alienation situation.
And I would think the difficulty is that you can't, I mean, for lack of a better term, you can't legislate behavior in the home. Like, you're not going to be able to, how do you control the words or actions of the parent that's the one that's alienating I mean, it's like
in California, there is a law. Actually, in California, there is a law.
Interesting.
And we write it into the settlement agreements that neither parent may make negative or disparaging remarks about the other parent. It's a family code. You can call the other parent on that, especially in the world of videotaping and audio taping now. You can definitely get that. So, yeah, they had to make it a law because depending on how you deal with the divorce, you may use your child as a weapon. You may weaponize your child against the other spouse. And they think, some people think nothing of it. They don't even see it that way.
Yeah. Well, because it's, you know, there's a fair amount of selfishness, you know, especially in that, in the heat of that big, of that situation. There's, you know, there, everybody seems, it's easy to be self-serving. And, you know, what you want. And I mean, the weaponization of children is just ridiculous. And I've seen it firsthand and it's nasty. It's, it can be really hard.
How did you respond when you were 12 and said, I would like to go live with my dad now?
Well, it's a statute. So it actually, like, it was, I don't know how close it was to my 12th birthday, but it was very close. Like, it was like, I bided the time and I said, okay, dad, this is your weekend. You know, come get me a day early or whatever. And then we went before the judge and it's statutory at that point. So literally the child gets to make that decision. So it was just, you know, he asked me, who do you want to live with? I want to live with my dad, you know, gavel pounded. I assume I have no actual memory of this happening. But that's pretty much the way I understand it.
Okay. Can I speak to men a second in terms of, you don't have a situation where it's alienation. You have a situation where mom simply wants the child to be taken care of. Now, by both of them. Now, how does this look? What does this mean? And dad has a very high powered job. Dad has always made a ton of money. But in order to make a ton of money, you're not home a lot. Right. You know, you have to be out if you're going to make a lot of money. Now, dad has a decision in the divorce situation. Do they ask for 50-50 co-parenting time, meaning you get as much time as you know, you split the time in half? And in so doing, are you developing latchkey kids because you're not changing what you're doing for a living so that you can be with your children? You're giving them to your parents, the grandparents, or
the nanny.
You know, what does this look like if you want to continue living the life that you have been living? And maybe you can't help it. This is who you are. You are a worker. You're a type A personality. But you can also provide for your children better because you're this type A personality that makes a lot of money. Then don't do that. Don't ask for half the amount of time. You're not doing your child a service. Look at your schedule and your time realistically. If you can pare back at all anywhere, do it so that when you're with your children, you put that cell phone away and you're with your children. Even if you're with them every other weekend and dinner on a Wednesday night, you're all in for your children.
You need treat it like you do with your, I mean, if you're a business person, treat it like you're doing business. You know, you would block if you're they're the most important client you have, right? Like if you're, treat it that way. You turn everything off just like you would with your most important client. You're not going to take another business call during dinner with one of your most important clients. You shouldn't do that with your kids either. It takes that,
that dedication. I'm going to use that, Kevin.
Feel free. This is all free advice, right? You get what you pay for.
Yeah, well, you're using Rebel Light, so I'm going to use, you know, your
there you go. I think that's an even trade. So, I mean, we're, you know, to kind of wrap this up, what for men that are in this situation now, like just starting it, or if they're kind of in the middle of this, what, and I know every situation is different, but there are there certain resources that you would send them to, or their kind of thought process, you know, this is kind of how you think through things or how you take these steps.
Okay. So men are in the middle of getting divorced and they have children. Is that the example that we're using?
Sure. Yeah. We can use that as a good, that's a great place.
Okay. You know, first of all, analyze who you are as a dad and how you want to be as a dad going forward, because you're not a dad in the house with mom there, you know, doing things while you're at work. So analyze the dad you want to be going forward for your children. If you feel that you didn't spend enough time with them, change your life so that you can spend more time. If there's an apology you need to make to your soon-to-be former wife, apologize and make it heartfelt, because that will change everything. A real apology will change it. Maybe she'll say, all right, so fine, you're apologizing now. Why did you? Women are very unforgiving.
Yeah.
Let it be the way it is. You just do your part to stand up in your truth and just say, I'm so sorry things happened this way. I'm so sorry this was my contribution, but we have these children and I want to dedicate myself to being the best dad possible. And I'm going to work hard at it. I mean, who can fault somebody for that?
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty hard to take that down for sure.
Okay. Now resources. Well,
and go ahead and lay out your, you know, go ahead and lay out your resources for your personal stuff too. That'd be a good time to do that.
Well, okay. So I do coaching. I do coaching on this thing I invented called Recipe for a Heart Healthy Divorce. And Recipe for a Heart Healthy Divorce has four quick ingredients. It's an aggregation of things I've learned over the past 12 years, not only from my clients, but from experts I've interviewed on the podcast. First step. Settle the emotional divorce before you file for the legal divorce. You need to get through all of that so you can make sound legal decisions. Number two, learn communication skills for conflict. You're going to need them. The words we choose and the tone of voice we use means everything when we're in conflict. You can get back control in your life if you know how to communicate. And there's a gentleman that I refer to all the time. His name is Bill Eddy, E-D-D-Y. He's written 30-some books on communicating in high-conflict situations. And it works, Kevin. It works every time. Number three.
Also, those skills can come in handy in preventing divorce, probably.
Well, yes, that's good. And they come in handy in any conflict.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, negotiations and all that too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a certain way to deal with people that neutralizes a situation. And you know how we've been in situations and we say, dang, I didn't handle that right. If I only could have said X instead of saying Y. I'm going to teach you the tools to say Y. You no longer have to regret saying X. Number three, compartmentalize time so that you're not living the divorce every second of the day. So you can function and think and keep your job together and have a balanced life. And then lastly, a self-care program with laughter. So exercise is phenomenal, but if you can exercise with laughter, that's great. So my suggestion is goat or puppy yoga. Now, of course, in LA, we're very advanced with these concepts. But this goat yoga started on a goat farm in Vermont. Two women were teaching yoga. The goats got out one day of their pen and they're walking all over and around the women. Everybody's hysterical. So I went to a goat yoga class. I have photographs of goats.
I think I saw that on your LinkedIn. Actually, it looked hilarious.
Thank you so much. You laugh, you exercise. So these are the four components. And I teach this in private coaching, or we can do classes. So that's the one thing I would like to leave.
And where do they go to find that information?
DivorceResourceInc.com. Okay. DivorceResourceInc.com.
And your podcast is the Amicable Divorce Expert Podcast?
Yes. Yes. Awesome. And we have great guests. I'm starting to do more episodes myself because I want a lot of it to be very personal, one-on-one. I want people to feel like I'm speaking just to them, calm them down, and get them to focus. But we have great guests on the show.
Nice. Nice. I'll have to check that out myself. Always educational.
Always. And I love your podcast. First of all, I love the name of it.
Thanks. Yeah, we've got this whole the whole project has been fun. I mean, I'm a 50-year-old, happily married, good kids, financially stable. So I'm like, I see all these things in my life, and my goal is to use what I've learned, just like you're using what you've learned, to help other men. And in this case, I always say, to be who you were made to be. Like, wherever you're starting, there's always a way to go up. There's always a way to improve. And that's what I love about this podcast, is because, like, you and I would probably never have this conversation. You know, it's just a rare situation. And to be able to talk to men's experts and experts in health and fitness and testosterone and divorce and marriage and all of these things, it's been phenomenal. This is so much fun for me.
And I feel the same way about my podcast too. I just really enjoy talking to people and seeing how they think, and thereby improving myself at the same time. So this has been a pleasure.
100%. Thank you so much. And what's funny is that my wife said, you are becoming you, because I have to learn to listen. I what's ironic about me doing a podcast is I talk a lot. And so this has forced me to keep my mouth shut and be a better listener. So it's helping my marriage also. So
I love your wife. She gave you great advice, and I think you handled yourself beautifully.
Thank you very much. Yeah, she's pretty awesome. Well, thank you so much, Judy. I hope you have a great day, and we'll keep in touch for sure. And people need to go check out your podcast. Go check out, what was the website again?
DivorceResourceInc.com.
Thank you very much. All right, well, have a great day.
You too.
If you're looking to really maximize your life and become the man you were made to be, head over to maxedoutman.com and get your journey started today.